Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen. If you're joining us, you've probably just watched episode 110. Thank you, James, which came out this week, in which we reviewed Ferrari and Anyone But You. You've probably listened to it and you enjoyed it so much, you were like, I want some more Pulp Kitchen. Mm. Well, here we are with the bonus episode where we're talking about all the films that we watched in the time that we were off between Christmas and New Year.
A combination of the films that we just, for some reason, didn't quite get to. Maybe you saw it first and I didn't get to it. Premieres, London Film Festival. Yep. Now we managed to catch up over the winter period to touch in on each other's reviews, absolutely, say what we thought. Also, some older films that we were just either watching for the first time or things we'd kind of seen or rewatching. And we thought we'd just, instead of trying to break up a huge main episode, we'll just put this all in a bonus so you guys can find out what we thought.
A nice buffet selection. James, the first film I want to ask you about is a 2023 release, which I was really excited to get your opinion on, mm-hmm, because I saw it last year, was really surprised by it. That is Blackberry.
Yes.
You've seen it for the first time. I must say, I also rewatched it this Christmas as well with my family.
Yes. All of these are going to be quick reviews, so quick. Please go and reference our actual reviews that either one of us did from weeks ago to get sort of more deep dive in them.
Absolutely. If you want to know the exact plot and detail, etc., return to the original reviews.
But very quickly, BlackBerry covers the rise and very quick downfall of the BlackBerry phone, how it became this
the world's first smartphone. That's the key
phone, a phone that did email to, leading up to the rise and the announcement of the iPhone. I will say, you know that week where I went home and I was sick? Mm. I actually tried to watch this with my mum that week. I was sick and my mum was like, why don't we watch a film tonight? We'd done Maestro the day before, like, why don't we watch a film? And I was like, oh, like, I've got BlackBerry, why don't we watch it? George said it was great, meant to be good. And she was like, yeah, sure. And I was not in a good space. I was not feeling well. I was very tired. It was like 9:15, which is a little too late to start a film, especially if you're sick. And I started it and I was falling asleep, and it's not the film's problem. I had a terrible, terrible time to do it. My mum straight away noticed I was asleep. She was like, I'm not enjoying this. Let's do a new film. I don't want to do it. So I ended up like cancelling BlackBerry after like 12 minutes, which is not its fault. Anyway, BlackBerry, I really liked it. Especially after the beginning when Glenn Powell comes in. Glenn Howerton comes in and he is just like this unstoppable, immovable force. Mm. He's really funny. He's really dynamic. And I really enjoyed it. I think Jay Baruchel's great. Mm. I realized how much I love tech and the history behind the tech and how these conversations were had. All these things I totally forgot about. The idea of switching from purchasing minutes and texts as a payment plan for these providers, that shift over to data, so interesting. When he says, why would they not want to buy minutes? And he's like, because there's only
one
so many minutes
in a minute.
Yeah. And whereas data is an infinitely scalable thing. Just so interesting. The struggling of them trying to find a solution to the keyboard touchscreen thing after the iPhone had been announced. Mm. Just really, really good. I would have loved to have watched another hour of the film, weirdly, of just the next chapter in history. Switch focus. I think a mini series on that whole thing would just be brilliant. Really like BlackBerry.
I must just say, I rewatched it with my family, and I was thinking the whole time, it took me completely by surprise when I first saw it. I really enjoyed it. Is it gonna be a fluke? Is it gonna be just as good the second time round? And you know what? I enjoyed it just as much the second time round. Yeah. All my family loved it. They were hooked. They thought it was gripping. That it was excellent. It was one of Barack Obama's top films of last year.
If you like The Social Network, it's kind of similar to
really
that.
It's witty, and you're right. That the sort of especially that first act with Glenn Howerton coming in and dealing with Jay Baruchel, sort of cracking these nerds' skulls together. Yeah. There's a great bit where it's like, he doesn't even have an office, and he's grabbing the phone. And he's like, you've lost the deal with US Robotics. Let me get them on the phone. Right. The modems are broken. How much have you lost? He's like, 1.2 million. He's like, where did you get 1.2 million from? He's like, I just took out a loan. So Jesus Christ. And then he gets on the phone and he sent this guy, you got to take the modems back. You know, you retake our deal back. And the guy goes, okay, it's fine. If you throw in the patent for the phone. And that's the first time that someone else has mentioned it. And Glenn Howerton just looks at Jay Baruchel, hangs up the phone, and that's when he knows the phone has value. And they go, he's like, we are
he's
behind.
He's not a tech guy at all.
He's like,
doesn't know anything.
We are behind. We are in a race. How soon can you get me something to market?
Yeah.
And it's really gripping, funny, good needle drops. Just like
that great, one of my favorite moment, that really good scene where he goes to pitch to Verizon for the first time. And Glenn Howerton's trying, but he's not a tech guy. He's all broad and bullshit. Yeah. And Jay Baruchel comes in and he's like, what got like 10 phones on the network before it crashed? It's like, well, you're probably doing it this way. Well, we have a solution. And then like the classic nerd in front of the corporates gets the dartboard. Well, if you do this, you make all of them the servers. I sound like a weird joker.
But that's also like that
really good scene.
At that point, Glenn Howerton has been the dominant figure.
And he's been made a schmuck.
And then he's been made a schmuck, you're right. Yeah. And then Jay Baruchel like saved the moment.
Yeah, and how much they pictured the BlackBerry office is just this A bunch of nerds who love movie nights just scrambling to try and find something.
With a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle wallet that he puts out the cafe Velcro.
It's fun. It's funny. It's really interesting.
Yes.
And it's a really interesting deep dive in history that's recent.
It really is kind of better than it should be. I think in a way, it looks like a very sort of bog standard. This one could have been so boring and so meaningless, but I think it's a really good, solid work.
Yeah.
From that, fittingly, from one 2023 corporate biopic to another, I watched Air, the Michael Jordan We Licensed a Shoe movie with directed by Ben Affleck, with Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and Jason Bateman, and people. We reviewed it last year, but as you know, the challenge of Nike, who were like the underperforming third in line shoe of America, to try and get Michael Jordan to sign on to license for the Air Jordan. And Joe, first of all, I think a film like BlackBerry is much better, that I have to say, than Air. Air is one of those films where when you're watching it, you're like, it really is a testament that if you throw enough money and enough A-list talent at something, it sometimes is enough to get you over the line. And Air, just about, like that, I said this on Letterboxd, like the title suggests, it kind of breezes along.
It's very easy. Enough.
It's such an easy watch.
Yeah.
I will say that, and it was fine, we all kind of, it surfaced, and it perfectly served the moment. We need something easy to enjoy. But I will say that thinking back on it, I am like, you really made a film about them trying to license a shoe. The dramatic stakes really couldn't be lower. And it has a very, there's this insistent point throughout the film where they just keep dropping needle drops. I'd say every 90 second, it's 80s hit, to keep you moving. And yeah, it makes it very watchable.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, it's because you're realizing that if you let people stop to think for too long, they'd be like, I'm just watching someone
buy a shoe.
I'm just watching someone pitch for business. It's just not that interesting.
Did you find it weird that Michael Jordan in every scene was like this?
What? Oh, yeah. I don't know. Back of his head.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
To the point where it was just too, his omission was
anyone
distracting for me.
I think
really distracting.
Air is a good film to fall asleep on a plane to. And I think if anyone's genuinely interested in that story, go and watch the 10-part series, The Last Dance.
Oh yeah, totally. I think, like someone said, Air is good because, you know, it's just a film. It's not one of those films that's just there and it's not about anything else.
Really,
it's just one of the, like stars, you know, an interesting story about a brand, you know, easy stakes. Yeah. Get in.
I think Nike gets a lot more out of that film than I did.
Yeah.
than you do as an audience. Yeah. But anyway, that was Air.
So another film that came out towards the end of last year that I missed, that I know you said you enjoyed, was Dream Scenario.
Yes, which I reviewed in a bonus episode last year with Nicolas Cage. It's the sort of story about Nicolas Cage as an average college professor and he keeps turning up in people's dreams.
Yeah.
And I reviewed it in a bonus episode. I was quite surprised. And I said, I wanted to know what you thought about it.
And it's an A24 film produced by Ari Aster, who's becoming the... you haven't seen Birds Afraid yet, have
no,
you?
No.
Becoming the poster child of somehow getting the strangest and weirdest concepts funded and put out in cinema, regardless if they made money. I think Bo is Afraid lost money, and I'm not surprised because that film is huge and does quite a lot. Anyway, Dream Scenario, it was refreshingly strange. Like, I enjoyed how weird it was, like how really, really weird it was, like trying to tell someone about your dreams.
Yes.
I thought so much of especially the first half of the film is really funny.
Yeah.
Like all the stuff with the crocodiles and the weird sexual stuff.
In the dreams. Yeah,
dreams. And just Nicolas Cage being a really perfect, you know, use for that. Yeah. I think there's parts of it which I think, you know, you're almost there. And it does sort of, it makes a really big point that I don't think I fully understand about fame,
cancel
culture, what it means to put yourself on a pedestal and what it means to react to it. And all of that's very interesting. And it sort of almost reaches this high, sort of quite a sad, somber part towards the end.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. I watched it with Talia and she was a bit like, this is a weird, this is a really weird film. And we're not really sure what to make of it, but glad it exists. Glad that beautifully shot, a really present film stock. Do you know what I mean? A film stock you really like reach out and touch. Mm. That and May, December are very much of this aesthetic, which I'm really seeing as a trend. Present film stock and these sort of long zoom shots on already zoomed. Zoom shots are very trendy right now in cinematography, I will just say.
I thought Cage was great, isn't it?
Very good.
Really good. And I thought there's a couple of scenes where I was like, that's really fun. The whole scene.
The agency scene.
The agency scene is brilliant. And also with the woman from the agency afterwards. Uncomfortable, funny.
Strange. But really strange. Like can you know the dark corner that he has to stand in? He's like, can you stand there? And he's doing it and indulging in it. The thoughts agency was so fun. It's like, like, so we're thinking Sprite.
Yeah.
And then the following phone call where it kind of, you know, slightly unravels for him. Yeah, and then like later scenes with the influencers, I thought was just, yeah. I was really laughing at that.
I liked it just when they were like depicting people's dreams and Nicolas Cage would just walk in and his like quarter zip and stuff.
Yeah, sometimes he was like the subject of the dream and he was like the villain or he was chasing or he was there. Other times he's just walking past and just happens to be there.
It's not perfect. It's a little flawed, but it doesn't fall apart like these films normally do. He's really funny in it. And it was really delightfully strange.
Yeah.
So I saw Dumb Money from last year as well, which you reviewed in a bonus episode about the GameStop thing that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Dumb Money in the sense that it is, I came away being like, I now understand what happened at GameStop in 2021. I don't think it's not up there. It's not as slick as something like BlackBerry or as incisive, but you, again, you got enough A-list talent in there, a big ensemble cast. It's interesting enough, and I now understand that story.
Do you mean by the Love Actually comparison?
Yes, I do.
That's what I thought about that. It's like a finance Love Actually.
There's quite a lot of intrusive. Like my brother hated the intrusive like rap music, and I was like, well, that's just from the year, like it's from 2021, right, whatever. Yeah. It's interesting. It's directed by Craig Gillespie, who directed I, Tonya, and a film that I completely forgot until we came out because I went to see Wonka again with my family. Mm. My thoughts were exactly the same, even slightly less on that film now. And my brother said, yeah, it's fine, but it's no Cruella. And I was like, whoa.
Oh,
and I was like, Cruella? And that was directed by Craig Gillespie as well. And I was like, I've not thought about that since then.
I saw that film.
And I saw it too, and I thought it was fine. And then my brother and my mum watched it, and they said, do you want to rewatch it? And I said, no, I think once was enough for Cruella. And
when was that?
2021. It's that kind of weird, slight coming out of COVID time. Wow. Anyway, but Paul Dano, great as ever.
Yeah. Nick Offerman is...
Nick Offerman, yes.
We're doing. Yeah, he's a real big star now.
Yeah,
he's doing well. Anyway, May, December, new Todd Haynes film that you saw quite recently, actually.
I reviewed it, I think, the same week we did Saltburn, yes.
Yeah, May, December, which is a new Todd Haynes film starring Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore.
Big Oscar contender.
Definitely.
Not necessarily for the film, but for performances, yeah.
Definitely. It's briefly, for those of you who don't know, it's about... This actress played by Natalie Portman, who is going to play Julianne Moore in a film. She is a TV actor who is, in a very like sort of method actor way, is deciding to spend some time around this woman to study her and try to understand exactly who this woman was to play her in a film. The dynamic that sort of is revealed to you fairly quickly is that Julianne Moore's character was a long time ago involved in this very public tabloid scandal where she, with her husband who she now lives with, basically had an affair with when the boy was 13 years old, 14 years old.
She was 36.
And she was 36. And this is now picking up, you know, sort of at the age where her husband is now 36, so decades later. And it's all about her trying to understand and essentially like morph herself into this person. And, you know, it's very evocative and it's very enticing. And this film really draws you. There's more to say on what this film's about, but please go and check out George's review. I thought it was really interesting and rich and dense. And like, it really draws you in from the get-go. And I think it's very good at drip-feeding you information and like letting you know more in a really... It's a very simple execution of a very complicated issue, I thought. And, you know, you start with a very clear moral compass on what I think these characters... what I think of these characters, and just that whole framing of what I think starts to really unravel towards the end, which I quite enjoyed. It's frustratingly opaque to watch, and it becomes more and more, like I said, your opinions on the characters are changing, and the film, I think, lets you in less and less the more these characters seem to study each other, which I actually think is quite interesting. And I do think that's intentional. So the more it hides from you, the more I think you want to see. And some of the last words exchanged between the two characters are some of the most interesting, despite being, as an audience member, a bit frustrating.
Right, thank you.
The performances are so good. I love how much Elizabeth, which is Natalie Portman's character, really shifts in the beginning to be a character that's quite sympathetic to someone that you really feel such a distance from. The score, so strange.
Yes.
The first time I heard it, this like, da-na-na-na-na-na.
It's like melodrama.
Melodrama, piano chime. The first time I heard it, I was like, that's a strange undertone for the film. And it sort of consistently tells you.
And I believe it's taken from a previous film, and from the 50s.
50s, I think, or 60s that they, right, okay, like, I needed to, Todd Haynes was like, I needed to use that specific piece of.
And so we're always telling you, like, by the way, this is not right. By the way, this is weird. By the way, you should look under the surface. Something's very wrong. I like that. Loved the cinematography. Everything at a distance, everything observational, everything at far away, but zooming in closer and closer. Such beauty in the landscape, but no one really necessarily engaging with it. Just lovely. I thought maybe the caterpillar butterfly allegory a little bit on the nose, yes, and overused, but I'm still there for it. I agree. The performance of
Charles Melton,
really great. Interesting, really great. Some really great scenes, especially with Elizabeth and Charles Melton, that I thought just,
he's really good.
Kept the film going at a really interesting tone about being childish, being grown up, who has an authority over that in the first place. Just interesting and juicy.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I'm glad you said you found it slightly frustrating towards the end, because I left thinking, oh, that was good. I missed just that killer blow.
It almost seems like the last conversation between the characters is really interesting.
Yes.
And the ending of the film is like a real, this is our last scene, which is meant for interpretation. And I'm like, maybe I need one more.
Yes.
One more scene just to say this is what it is. But I do think that's intentional. I think Todd Haynes purposefully wants to keep the audience increasingly in the dark.
With Charles Melton as well, I'll say that he's got a good couple of scenes in it. But this isn't a spoiler to say, but the film, it builds up to a graduation at the end of Charles Melton and Julianne Moore's children. And there's a shot of Charles Melton in that, during that event. I was like, man, that's really... I really get everything that character's going through. And I really... And there's a lot of Oscar buzz for him to be at least nominated for... Best supporting actor, probably.
Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore, both really good. They have, you know, what they have?
No surprises there.
Again, intentional. They have a really good lack of chemistry, like an intentional lack of chemistry for the scene. They don't quite really mesh.
It's awkward.
It's awkward, and like the sort of loss of identity onto the other is quite interesting.
And Julianne Moore with the lisp.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was okay. Good, because it's one of those ambiguous ones. I'm glad to hear another person's opinion of, so I can kind of chew through it. Moving on now to non-2023 films, old classics we've revisited or perhaps seen for the first time. Mm-hmm. So, James, I'm at home. It's Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. And my family are like, what are we going to watch tonight? Do we watch a Christmas film? Do we watch this? Everyone's appetite is a little bit skewed. Mm-hmm. We've all had colds. Everyone's a bit tired. What do we fancy watching? And everyone's a bit like, ah. And I was like, I think we should watch something different. I think we should change it up a little bit. You want to watch something wintry and cold? I'll give you something. Let's watch The Thing. Yeah. Exactly, right? And my mum was...
It's cold, but with nothing coziness about it.
Yeah, exactly. And my mum was like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. And Joe was like, yeah, sure. And my dad was, whatever. I said, you've seen Alien, you like Alien. It's a bit like that same era. And we put it on, and I'm thinking, I have no idea how this film's going to play.
Have your family seen it?
Never before. They've never seen it. No, crucially, they've never seen
The Thing before.
Like, they'd never heard of it.
Never
at all. They were like, they were completely bemused, but they just said, okay, well, yeah, we'll trust you. And I was thinking, okay, I have no idea this is going to go. Put all the lights down low, turn it on, and it's got that fantastic boom.
Turn the radiators off.
Boom, boom. Boom, boom. And I'm thinking, okay, rub my hands together. It's cold. It's the Arctic. Antarctic, rather. Not only did I, it's probably my fourth time of seeing it, and I was like, yes, this film rips.
I need to see it again. I've seen it once. I need to see it.
You've seen it once?
I've only seen it once,
It's really
like
good.
When I was 22 or something.
And I was really delighted to see that all three members of my family really enjoyed it too. Yes. They were like, the effects were, I was with the really like nasty practical effects in it. Yeah, I was looking at them and they're all like,
it's horrible,
but they were really leaning into it, and I was delighted, and they agreed. They found it very sort of cold and atmospheric, and I really didn't think it would be all of their. I thought one of them wouldn't like it, but all three of them responded to it and said, "Oh, that was actually pretty good." Because I think what works for The Thing is that it's inherently just a really good, simple science fiction concept.
Yeah,
this fear of something that you can't see, this cloning thing. Really liked it. You should see it again because it's great. There's one of my favorite.
I'd love to catch it in cinema if I can.
Not to focus on like a specific, always focus on specific shots, but you have this just slowly escalating sense of things getting out of control. More and more people die, more and more people potentially being the thing. And there's a bit where MacReady just solves something and then the fire alarm goes off and he bursts in and he runs down the corridor and the camera is like running quickly in front of him. So you've got this real sense of pace because the walls are going past him very quickly. It's just a great action shot. And at that moment, I was like, I'm so into this
film. I think it's quite good to cleanse the palate at Christmas time.
That's
from the Mary Poppins, Paddington Wonka, just something a little bit
That's what I thought.
A little bit crunchy.
We'd seen Wonka already. We'd seen like Dumb Money. These were kind of safe films. Yes. And I said, let's light a fire under us. Hey. Oh, I had a new theory about the ending of the thing as well.
Okay. Just in case. People had a go at me for talking about the end of Gladiator last week.
Did they?
Yeah.
Some people messaged and were like...
Some people were like, well, we played a game about... I said names six...
Yeah, I didn't sanction that game before James did it. I would have done because why would I name...
Leave it because people are often convinced to go watch stuff.
Go and watch the thing.
Yeah. So on my list, Pile of Shame, films that I hadn't seen was Dirty Dancing.
Yes.
And you went to a secret cinema recently, did you?
2022. I think I saw that film 4 times that year.
Wow. Yeah. So Tally had seen it, loved it. And I was like, why don't... She was like, what are we going to watch tonight? And I just threw it out there. I had it in my back pocket. I was like, let's watch Dirty Dancing. And she was like, yeah, clapping, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, watch it in bed. Watch Dirty Dancing. I mean, I could only do it in so many words. Brilliant. Loved it. Yeah. Beautiful. So charming and sweet. Loved the portrayal of the Catskills. And actually like the end of that era of families before they were rich enough to take themselves to Europe and this like... lightning in a bottle fever pitch of all of these people mixing in one space. That scene when she takes the watermelon across the bridge
brilliant.
And up to go and
carried a watermelon.
Our forbidden fruit up to like temptation red inside. And you see Patrick Swayze just in his prime.
Patrick sexy
just dancing with those tiny hips in those black trousers. Charming, sweet, way more dramatic than I thought the film was. In my head, having not seen it, I thought it would have been, I wrongly thought, it's a little bit sort of surface and superficial, but it actually goes and tries to tackle quite a lot of dealing with abortion and all of these
unplanned pregnancies,
things I really didn't think it would cover, if it did, sort of like in a Grease way.
Yes,
surpassingly. Yeah, exactly like in a Grease way. But it doesn't. It has a little bit of dirt under its nails, and all of those iconic scenes were great to see all the build up towards it. And I had a great time with it.
What I love about I am going to spoil Dirty Dancing here because I'm sorry, that film is so.
Well, spoiler warning for Dirty Dancing.
That's a little bit more scene than the thing. But first of all, I'm really glad you've seen it. I'm really glad you liked it. I think it's good. And like that's exactly the same reaction I had when I first watched it. I was like, oh, there's actually much more meat on this than I realized. I still think it's probably the most rewatchable film ever. It's very easy to watch without being stupid.
Again.
It's not like it's completely airheaded and you throw it on. I'm like, I can actually throw Dirty Dancing on any time and get through it and enjoy it. The ending of what I love about the ending of Dirty Dancing is that in a way it's such a small climax.
Yeah.
It's in a room. It's in a like an assembly room.
Yeah.
And the main climactic moment is just the lift.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. And when it happens, you're like, yeah.
And it's not in front of like a new crowd of external influences. It's the same crowd of people.
There's a line I've always really found funny at the end of Dirty Dancing where the Lou Kellamus, who runs the holiday park, is saying to like one of his staff, he's like, it's all changing now. Everything's ending. Kids don't want to come away with their parents anymore. They want to go away to Europe. 22 countries in 3 days. And every time I watch that, Anna and I are like, 22 countries insane. In 3 days.
Must be on a train.
You couldn't do 22 countries in 3 weeks. I don't think really, not properly. No. We calculated it. You would have to spend 3 hours in every country if you didn't sleep.
Yes.
That's how you would do it.
Must be on like some sort of train that goes through like from the Alps through Germany.
I honestly think it's maybe the actor said the line wrong and no one realized or something. Maybe he meant to say like
12 countries.
22 countries in 3 weeks.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, I love it. And the lift is great and the lines are funny and the music's good and it's hot. It's sexy.
So sexy.
And a baby is a really good character. She's got agency, she's smart,
so observational, but not in a boring way, like a character who just she observes and it changes her every single time, every scene. She I feel like she's a different person.
Do you
completely
know, the woman who wrote it, the script got rejected all over town, and what she would start to do is she would attach a cassette tape of all the music that should go into it, right? And she would send it around. And people would send it back to her, rejected, but say, by the way, I wore that cassette out. Could you send me another one? And she was like, do you not see what you're saying?
Yeah.
The potential is right here. Totally. Anyway, I rewatched an iconic film over Christmas, which was, of course, The Silence of the Lambs, which is one of those films that it's so big and so iconic and parodied.
Dr. Lecter.
Yeah, to approach it, you kind of think, oh, here we go again. How's this going to hold up? So that film came out in 1991. directed by Jonathan Demme, who we talked about last year because he directed Stop Making Sense.
Surprised that didn't make it into your Pop Kitchen Awards, by the way. I guess it's because it's an old film. It's such a big part of your 2023.
I mean, I really wish I had. To be totally honest with you,
Did you see it four times?
I saw it three times.
Three times.
But it was because I'd seen it before.
Yeah, and it wasn't a new film.
Yeah. But definitely the best cinematic experience I had last year. And with Silence of the Lambs, I watched with my parents who, for a long time, had always been put it off, saying, yeah, I've seen it. No, it's been parodied. I don't want to do it. But now it's been long enough that they said, I said, can we watch Silence of the Lambs? And they were like, you know what? We've forgotten everything about it. Anyway.
Your family are so happy to just like...
that someone's taking control.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And you know what? It was really great. It was great again. I mean, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Seen it a long time ago now. Yeah. I think it's 18, 19.
Right, so it's definitely worth the rewatch again.
Yeah, yeah.
Still holds up, still great. My parents loved it and they were like, we don't remember any of this stuff. Mm. It's really great. All the stuff that's heavy, you know, all that stuff is actually quite early on in the film. So you kind of get past the heavily iconic stuff and then you can get back to enjoying the film without thinking, oh, where's the famous line going to be? You know, the fava beans and the Chianti is probably in the first half an hour. What I find really interesting about The Silence of the Lambs when I was watching it, I was like, it's iconic for a reason. This really is very influential. You can just see when you're watching it, the ingredients and everything. Like
Those scenes are so memorable.
Well, yeah, but it's like, you just kind of has this kind of raw power that, obviously, things like Mindhunter, the TV series, takes a lot because, you know, you're profiling serial killers. But I actually, when I was watching it, I think The Dark Knight somehow is loosely inspired by Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
I know Nolan says about like using heat. And it's more about this broiling escalation of a very spectacular villain. But you also have this kind of three-way dynamic between, because Hannibal Lecter isn't the villain. It's Buffalo Bill who's committing the crimes and Clarice Starling has to work with Hannibal Lecter. And in the same way, it doesn't quite operate the same way in The Dark Knight, but you have the Batman, Joker and Two-Face, you know, Harvey Dent. And there's a scene in Silence of the Lambs where, you know, Buffalo Bill's taking another woman and the sense of urgency is escalating and they have to move Hannibal Lecter out of the prison and he's in an airport hangar and there's police cars turning and the music's building up. And I was like, yeah, this really feels like in The Dark Knight where everyone is kind of losing their minds with the rising terror that the Joker is inspiring.
It's that scene when Batman interrogates the Joker and he's trying to punch him. You realize he's trying to beat and punch an idea.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, actually, you can't. That's what Batman was. Yeah. You can't destroy a symbol. I think
Clarice Starling is a really interesting character. I think the dynamic between him, Lecter, and Starling is brilliant. I think I was amazed that despite it being so iconic and so influential that it hadn't exhausted itself and looked dated by comparison. You know, sometimes when something is so influential, you go back and look at it and you go, oh, but everything now has been done better.
Yeah.
It does this really interesting thing. Actually, this is my main takeaway, was that it's shot, everything is shot in very, very tight close-up on people's faces, but people talking directly to the camera in direct address, which creates this really unsettling, strange point of view. It's just, I thought, actually, I haven't seen a thriller in a long time. Most thrillers you assume is being shot kind of in a mid to a long range to get a sense of a sense of drama and scene, you know, like a diner with a cop car outside kind of thing.
Mm.
And having these real tight close-ups was really cool. And actually, there's a scene where Clarice Starling is speaking with her, I can't remember the character's name, speaking with her police colleague. She's only in the FBI Academy, actually, so it's just like a fellow student on top of the washer dryer trying to crack the case. And I was like, oh my God, this almost breaks the Bechdel test, actually, in a way. You've got two characters. That character is named. They've got two female characters who are both named, are having a conversation about something other than men. I know they're talking about a man's violence against women, which doesn't quite go as far, but it's in a work context. They're talking about work.
Mm.
And honestly, the way it's shot, it's in that real tight close-up and the way they're looking at each other, I generally think there's like a queer reading you can put on that moment, because the admiration, the way that her colleague, friend, FBI partner looks at her is with such admiration and respect for Clarice's mind, for the way she's thinking about it. Mm. She's like, that's brilliant, Clarice. And it's really striking. I was like, there's so much in this film that's interesting. There's also a moment as well where I thought, oh God, this is where the film's going to put its foot in its mouth, where she's talking with Hannibal Lecter about Buffalo Bill, and the topic of transsexualism comes up, about Buffalo Bill being a transsexual. And I thought, oh no, we're not going to go down a path where you associate, you know, deviancy or violence with transsexualism. But luckily, Clarice Starling's line immediately afterwards is, there's no correlation between violence and transsexualism. And Hannibal Lecter then says, I know, and Buffalo Bill isn't a transsexual. He's actually feigning that because actually he's got this thing over here. And I was like, crisis avoided, thank God, otherwise this would be an uncomfortable watch.
Yeah.
So Silence of the Lambs, shocker, still great. It's
clear, I think Anthony Hopkins' most distinct performance.
Oh, it's
of
iconic.
All the things he's done.
Absolutely.
It stands out as the most different performance I've seen from him off the top of my head.
I will just say, sorry, just finished. First thing, I think there's a needle drop in it of Goodbye Horses by Q Lazarus, which is not that famous a song. It's basically only famous for being used in this, but it's a real banger. I think it's one of my favourite needle drops ever because it's just such a good song and fits it so well.
Yeah.
Also, I actually would like to go back and see Manhunter, which is the original Hannibal Lecter movie they made with Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter, which was directed by Michael Mann. In the early 80s, and that's meant to be quite stylish and different. I'd like to see a kind of we associate that character so much now with Anthony Hopkins. I'd like to see a
I'd always heard great things about the show Hannibal.
Yes, with Mads Mikkelsen.
Mads Mikkelsen. Loads of people love that. Anyway. Another one in my a film that I had not properly seen when I was a lot younger, but I couldn't really count and say, you know what, I've really seen this as a grown-up. So, like, I remembered a lot of it, but Annie Hall.
Yes.
So, like, obviously, Woody Allen stuff completely separately. It's very much present and there when I'm watching the film. I won't go into it, but, you know, like, there just is that ickiness about Woody Allen. Watching the film, it is great. And I think, you know, the second half of it, I liked way more than the first. Something about Woody Allen,
it's been a while
probably intentional, is very irritating. Yeah. He's very, like, feeble and perverted, and he sort of, like, clings on to Annie Hall while she's walking and, like, protective and things like that. So much of his behaviour is just icky and quite irritating, especially if you don't like Woody Allen-style comedy. I actually do find Woody Allen-style comedy. I love Larry David, Jerry Seinfeld. It all kind of goes under that umbrella. But it is so funny and it's so smart. And all of the breaking the fourth wall quips and the little sketches and bits from his childhood are just so well done. Yeah. I love how most of the film is not just such a strong sense of place. It's not just a love letter to New York. It's a hate letter to Los Angeles. The way in which he depicts all the things he hates about LA, which anyone could say about New York, that... the like eating near roads, like loudness in the street. Every time he's in LA, the road sound is just blasted and no one can hear what they're saying. There are so many funny moments when he's at these LA parties and like this little bit where Jeff Goldblum thinks that he was like, hi, is that my therapist? I forgot my mantra.
Yeah, Jared, I forgot my mantra. Yeah.
so but like loads of moments where like little parts of that script are so rewarding.
Yeah.
And that writing of that rom-com really wants you to listen, and it's so well done. And I did have to sort of give the film that for being.
You long for rom-coms
to have that much to say as Annie Hall.
Yeah, I've only seen it once, about 10 years ago, but I remember being really impressed by how inventive and snappy and sharp it is. And it's definitely lower down on the, in hindsight, problematic films that he's made. Like, I know Manhattan apparently is quite icky now, but I'd be keen to watch it. And you know, Diane Keaton sort of in the lobsters, Kay. What are you doing? Okay, Annie.
Speaking of lobsters,
yes,
I watched The Lobster,
right?
Yorgos Lanthimos, a lobster film that a lot of people had said they'd really liked and really recommended to me. And I thought, you know what, I fancy some Lanthimos. I'm about to watch another Lanthimos in Poor Things. I've seen The Favourite. The Lobster, I liked. I didn't love it. I think the second half to me, you've seen it. No, you haven't seen it.
No, I haven't seen it.
The second half to me is much more interesting than the first. Do you know the premise of The Lobster?
Is about like finding
it's about this dystopian oppressive regime where people are basically, they have to find a romantic partner and they enter this program where Olivia Colman runs it. It's sort of very authoritarian, very violent, and you're meant to sort of mix with other people and everyone speaks in this very, that would be nice, I'd like to do that.
Yes.
Everyone tells the truth. Everyone's forced to tell the truth. Yeah. Kind of like the sort of messaging from this fascist regime means that you cannot possibly say what you really think, but therefore you have to fall in love. And if you don't fall in love within a certain time period, you will turn into your designated animal. And this guy decides that if he doesn't fall in love, he'll turn into a lobster. And it stars Rachel Weisz and John C. Reilly and Ben Whishaw. It's okay. Like a lot of Lanthimos, it can be very obtuse and irregular, and I don't think I was prepared for Lanthimos weirdness going in.
Yeah.
Even though I know what Yorgos Lanthimos is like. I'm just ready for poor things. So I actually just sort of had to recalibrate myself like half an hour in and be like, JJ, you know the kind of director you're watching, recalibrate. So the second half, I think the any sort of sadness or the somber note it goes to, I think sneaks up on you. And I think part of that works, but ultimately I don't think I connected with the film enough to say that it's one of my favorites.
He's very arch. And he likes to hold you at a distance. And
very much
that's
so.
Why I prefer, I know you haven't seen it, but that's why I like Killing of a Sacred Deer, because it's so, but because the plot of that is quite sinister and uncomfortable, it kind of works. Whereas I sometimes feel like when you're trying to do something else with that approach, I don't know. But yeah.
And it's like all of his, the films of his I've seen, very memorable and very interesting, but I can't say I've like loved one yet.
Yeah, I don't feel of anything, so I don't come away sort of beam with. But yes, I can see something.
I will watch Poor Things. I think it's like next Friday it's out, and we'll pick up on Lanthimos. But is that it? Are we done?
We're done,
guys. That was just our bonus episode for you. All the things that we caught up on. I enjoyed that.
Nice, I enjoyed that very much. That's what I love about Christmas and seeing all those films and kind of new and old and with a burst of energy. And
guys,
we don't always just talk about new stuff. We do like to talk about old films every so often.
And guys, if you've seen any of those recent films that we talked about or any of the older ones and you fancied writing in, do so to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. We would love to hear them out on the show.
And if not, we'll see you next Wednesday for our next episode of Pop Kitchen.
See you guys.
Bye.